Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, August 16th, 2018. Clashes between IDPs at the UN-run site in Juba leads to more problems.
There's no distribution because they are still throwing stone inside the POC, and humanitarians are fearful of what is happening. Therefore, the mission did not give them a situation green inside the POC.
And South Sudanese refugees in Uganda say they were attacked in the middle of the night.
He's trying to defend himself. He couldn't make it possible. He was beaten seriously.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Community leaders at a UN-run protection of civilians site in Juba say angry youth who were forced out of the camp after 2 days of fighting among IDPs are blocking roads leading to the area, preventing delivery of critically needed humanitarian aid to people in the camp. The camp chairman of POC3 says attempts to peacefully resolve the brawl between the two communities inside the camp have not been successful so far. Demo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Clashes between the two Nuer communities of Bull and Beach living inside the UN-run camp began on Monday after an argument that started between two teenagers quickly escalated when others in the camp got involved. Civilians at POC Site 1 and Site 3 used machetes, stones, sticks and knives to fight each other, leaving one person dead and more than 60 others injured. Community leaders say efforts to defuse tensions between the two groups have gone nowhere. Dozens of youths from one of the communities were forced out of the camp during yesterday's classes. Camp Management Deputy Chairperson Tech Chan Nyal says some of those young people returned to the area this morning and blocked aid agencies from delivering water and food to the camp.
There's no distribution because they are still throwing stone inside the POC, and humanitarians are fearful of what is happening. Therefore, the mission did not give them a situation green inside the POC.
Nyal says he worries if the situation persists, conditions in the POC could deteriorate even further.
Many people in the POC will suffer, and that thing will force a youth from the POC to move out and fight those people outside the POC site, that they will clear the way and humanitarians can be able to come to the POC, which is not a good idea, good decision to be taken.
Nyal says community leaders are still urging the two communities to peacefully resolve their conflict. Rit Kwajen, chairperson of the IDP's youth forum, says even if the fighting is diffused inside the POC, many IDPs are going hungry.
The only issue that IDPs are now facing is the issue of water. There are no enough water. Trucks are prevented not to enter into POC by those who are outside. Second, we're expecting food distribution in the last 2 days. But now, because of this incident, things are blocked. There are no car entering that could let this food distribution to happen. So people are angry.
Kwajen says enemy's peacekeepers used tear gas yesterday to disperse angry youths who were blocking the roads to the POC. But he says that was only a temporary fix.
This has been happening since the day of the starting of the incident, because they grouped themselves along the road leading from POC 3 to POC 1. That also is circulated so many people among the IDPs that if you wanted to go to POC 3, you could not be able to accept that road. So ANMIS has to go to disperse all those youths so that there should be a pre-movement. But today, I did not get any information of using tear gas by ANMIS, but yesterday it has happened.
Kwajen says today, movement inside the POC has been restricted and the IDPs are not able to go outside the camp even if they are trying to buy food. ANMIS acting spokesperson Joseph Mali tells South Sudan in Focus today that the situation at the POC sites is calm. In a statement yesterday, ANMIS called on groups to cease all acts of violence so that humanitarian actors can safely deliver food water and essential services to vulnerable civilians inside the POC. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
And there was more violence this week among South Sudanese refugees in Uganda. Three families, including a South Sudanese family living in a camp, say they were attacked in their home early Tuesday morning. Megumi Davis-Rakawinj has more from Kampala, Uganda.
The attack took place in Zambia, a Kampala suburb. Gatwech Kweny, member of the family, says the robbers took everyone in the combined household of three families by surprise.
We never knew the method they have used for the entry. They went with the other door. Me, I was living in the sitting room. And then the other members were sleeping in the room, inside room. So they came in with the door of the kitchen. They left me behind in the sitting room. I was with the other children.
Kony says the families, one from South Sudan, one from the DR Congo, and one from Uganda, were awakened when they heard one of the fathers struggling the assailants.
He's tried to defend himself. He couldn't make it possible. He was beaten seriously. Then also they beat the wife. We hear the noise after they have met their victories. The doubt also who came out from the other room, which is opposite to the room where the wife, the mom and the dad is living. So when she came out, because she had the noise, so also she was knocked on her head.
The Sasudin's father, mother and their 12-year-old daughter were immediately rushed to the hospital. The father has a broken leg and multiple cuts. The mother and the daughter have numerous cuts all over their bodies. South Sudanese Nyaleik Luha Riak, who lives in Kabalagala, a Kampala suburb next to Zambia, visits the family at the hospital. Speaking her native Nuer language, Riak says she was devastated when she saw relatives at Zambia hospital.
What happened is very disheartening because almost entire family of Mr. Ter has been shot by a machete. This is very inhuman and it makes everyone very sad. As South Sudanese in Uganda, we are not happy about what has happened and we feel insecure here in Uganda.
Nyaleik Riak fled to Uganda from Juba in 2014 with her eight children, leaving her husband in his camp in Juba for fear he would be killed. Nyaleik first lived in Uganda's Yandongo refugee settlement, but later left the area because she found life too difficult there. Nyaleik says it's unfortunate that people like her who sought refuge in Uganda because of the fighting back home in South Sudan now feel insecure in Uganda. South Sudanese human rights activist Gatwal Agustin says he was surprised by the brutal nature of this attack.
It doesn't look like robbery because it looked like a targeted incident that a particular family has been targeted and the attacker has special information about the house and about the family itself. Because it went straight to the master bedroom where the father was his wife and their 12 years old daughter.
The attackers did not steal any items from the house. Police officials refused to comment on the story, but acknowledged they received a complaint from the victims. Augustine says he's working with family members to do fundraising for the families. Robberies in parts of Uganda are common, affecting Ugandans and foreigners alike. About 1 million South Sudanese live in Uganda, many of whom fled the country after fighting erupted in late 2013. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kigali, Rwanda.
The Century, an initiative of the Enough Project, is asking member states of the United Nations to implement the travel ban and asset freeze that the UN recently imposed on certain South Sudanese officials accused of blocking peace in the country. Joshua White, director of policy and analysis at The Century, says his organization has confirmed that top South Sudanese military commander General Jock Riak, who was sanctioned by the UN in 2015, never received a UN waiver when he traveled to China for a meeting.
General Gabriel Jock Riak is subject to UN sanctions and has been since 2015. We recently learned that last month he traveled to China to attend a state-sponsored military conference, which is essentially an opportunity for them to buy weapons or to essentially enhance military cooperation with China. And in this case, it appears that the Chinese government let him travel without permission.
It should be the Chinese government that you need to put on the spot, because they allowed this South Sudanese general to enter their territory despite the UN sanctions, the travel ban on the South Sudanese.
It's critically necessary for sanctions and other tools of leverage not just to be put into place, right? So we recently saw another round of measures, the listing of two more individuals at the UN, an arms embargo, all of these new points of leverage and pieces of leverage to encourage the parties to actually adhere to power sharing agreement and adhere to agreements that they have previously reached but not implemented. It's not just important to bring those pressures to bear, but to also actually enforce them. And it's critical not just for China and Russia and countries around the world to do this, but also countries in the region. Gabriel Jacriak also has a home in Kampala that the Sentry has highlighted in its report 2 years ago, documenting his illicitly obtained wealth. The Ugandan authorities have not taken action against this house in Kampala, despite the fact that Gabriel Jacriak's assets are to be frozen.
China has been trading with South Sudan for quite a long time and with other countries around the world. And in this case, the issue of South Sudan, China seemed to be caring less, and it cares more about its business with South Sudan. What is the Enough Project doing, rather, to put China on the spot for working with people who are sanctioned?
We know that some countries around the world do not share the same views as we do when it comes to the need for additional pressures and the need for creating leverage to transform the corrupt and violent systems in place in countries such as South Sudan. But we engage based on legal obligation and technical best practice, because if these countries or these companies or whomever we're engaging with don't share our philosophical theory of change, then we need to make them understand what's at risk through speaking in terms of their obligations and what's financially in the best interest of their future as well.
And the parties in South Sudan, rather the warring parties, have been meeting in Khartoum, and it appears like they're making progress towards ending the conflict in South Sudan. Are instruments of diplomacy like sanctions and threats still necessary to make them, if you like, behave?
Absolutely. So what we are saying is that there have been a number of agreements that have not been fully implemented to date. You know, this, what has been agreed to in Khartoum, is a power sharing agreement that really, one, is a small piece of what really needs to be effectuated in order for real meaningful change to come to South Sudan. There are elements and sections of the previous agreement that still have not been brought to bear and have not been put into place in terms of governance and accountability and transparency.
That's Joshua White, Director of Policy and Analysis at the Sentry, an initiative of the Enough Project. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Washington earlier today. Tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a Ugandan lawmaker hauled into a military court today appears to have been roughed up. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
Have you been let down by someone you really trusted?
Yes, I've ever been let down by someone, and she was my friend, a lady. Yeah, once we got some misunderstandings with her, she revealed the secrets to the public. So, actually, it let me down. Yes, I felt much annoyed with her, and after all, we ended the relationship.
Yes, it's actually a cousin. I'd been helping to start up a business, so I gave them a loan, and they did not fulfill the payment schedule.
The friend I trusted most, he was a boy, but this man, he came to me, and I borrowed him some money. But by the time goes on, I asked for that money, he refused to bring it back.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A lawyer for Ugandan lawmaker Robert Kia Gulani says he appeared to have been badly beaten and could not walk when he was brought into a military courtroom today on charges of treason and terrorism. The lawyer told VOA Swahili service that Kia Gulani was transferred by helicopter from the army barracks in the town of Gulu to a military facility in Kampala. He goes back to court next week. Kia Gulani, also known as pop singer Bobby Wine, was arrested on Monday along with more than 30 other people after protests broke out during campaigning for a by-election. There are reports that stones were thrown at President Yoweri Museveni's car, breaking windows. Kia Gulani his driver was fatally shot, but police have yet to arrest anyone in the death. Kisianu Wadri, who won the election to parliament for the Arua municipality seat, and lawmaker Francis Zak are being held in the civilian jail in Gulu. They were also in court today and ordered held on charges of treason and terrorism. The army says Kia Gulani was found with two military guns, placing him under the military court's authority. Rights activists accuse Museveni's government of repressing opposition, which his supporters deny. While British police are continuing their investigation into the young man of Sudanese descent who drove into cyclists and pedestrians outside the British Parliament in London apparently yesterday, the suspect's acquaintances in Birmingham describe him as a normal person. Local media identified the suspect as Salih Khatter, a 29-year-old British citizen of Sudanese origin. A Facebook page for a man of the same name says he lives in Birmingham, works as a shop manager, and has studied at Sudan University of Science and Technology. In Birmingham, at the tower block where Khatter lives, a man believed to be his friend told British broadcaster Sky News that Khatter was a good block, fair block. He wasn't one of them people where you, like, think he's a terrorist or radicalized or whatever, said the man, who offered only his first name, Adam. Sky News also says police searched the suspect's apartment in Birmingham and an internet cafe in the city, above which Khatter used to live. A former landlord of Khatter, Mohammed Ismail, told Sky News that Khatter had always paid his money on time and, quotes, we never had an issue with him, end quote. A member of Birmingham's Sudanese community who knows Khatter said he believed the suspect had been in London to obtain a visa from the Sudanese embassy in order to visit Sudan. Nasser Mahmoud told Sky News that he was a British national, and we know from our own experience that the Sudanese embassy generally make it quite difficult for British nationals to gain a visa, said Mahmoud. The Tuesday incident is the second in less than 18 months in which a suspected extremist used a vehicle to attack the heart of Britain's government. Ugandan farmers are joining their counterparts in sub-Saharan Africa to develop a method of early detection of the fall armyworm, an invasive pest that originated in the Americas, but since 2016 has devastated crops in Africa. A new mobile phone application, the Fall Armyworm Monitoring and Early Warning System, may help farmers defeat the destructive larva, as Helma Altimani reports from Mukongo, Uganda.
The fall armyworm has already caused billions of dollars worth of crop losses in Africa and could cause billions more if not stopped. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and Uganda's Ministry of Agriculture says a new mobile application will help to eradicate the pest. Bahana John is a UN consultant on plants and pests. Farmers enter data that the app then uses to calculate infestation levels for appropriate action. Introduced in Madagascar and Zambia, the app is being rolled out across all of sub-Saharan Africa, where the fall armyworm has been found. Aonest Bongole lost half an acre of his 2017 crop to the invasive pest. He says, when the fall armyworm broke out, it took me a while to recognize it. By the time I knew it was the maize-destroying worm, my whole garden had been ruined. He says, from what I've learned here today and the trap we've been given to use, I hope to save crops compared to losing them as before. Stephen Biantwale Tibejuka is Uganda's commissioner for crop protection. The data farmers collect on the fall armyworm goes to a global web-based platform for analysis on ways to one day exterminate the invasive pest. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Mukono, Uganda.
AIDS activists say stigma remains one of the biggest challenges for those living with the disease. In some countries, those with HIV/AIDS often confront laws that make it hard for them to go about their daily lives. VOA's Kim Lewis has more.
The Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation was established by the late Hollywood actress and AIDS activist Elizabeth Taylor in 1991. The foundation provides grants to existing organizations for domestic and international programs that offer direct care services to people living with HIV and AIDS. Layla Wilding, the granddaughter of the late actress, is an ambassador with the foundation. She attended the AIDS conference to highlight that HIV stigmas still persist today. She said lack of communication and criminalizing people with HIV are major factors contributing to stigma.
Something that we're focused on in the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation is comprehensive sexual health education. We are hoping that by increasing communication in that area, that it will begin to reduce stigma in families and among young people. We find that young people aren't currently as aware of HIV as they once were.
Wilding says one of the most damaging types of stigma is the criminalization of a person who is living with HIV/AIDS. In many places around the world, this could mean labeling a person a sexual offender just because they are HIV positive.
In the U.S., we have two-thirds states that have laws that criminalize people living with HIV, and there are over 68 countries in the world that have similar laws. Often those laws are simply about disclosure. So we have tools to greatly reduce new cases of HIV, but we need to ensure access to tests, access to care, and to create environments where people are comfortable and encouraged to get tested and know their status.
Robert Suttle is an AIDS activist and advocate for people who have been stigmatized by outdated laws regarding HIV status. He was also a participant at the 2018 AIDS conference, not only as an advocate, but someone who has experienced firsthand this type of stigma.
To have these HIV criminalization laws, it's the greatest manifestation of stigma, and to have it enshrined in the law, and that pretty much allows for stigmatization legally. The point is they're outdated. They do not reflect the current science that we know today around HIV. And so as Layla has alluded to, we definitely have the tools to now start addressing HIV criminalization reform in a way that is proven and tested. Just recently, we had the opening of the HIV expert consensus statement that was released on July 25th here at the conference. And the statement was written both to assist scientific experts and anyone from a prosecutor or any type of government official that are considering criminal cases, that any application of the criminal law in the cases related to HIV is informed by any scientific evidence rather than stigma and fear.
Charged with not disclosing to a partner that he was HIV positive, Suttle was prosecuted and sent to prison in a U.S. state. He says he did disclose his HIV status to the person. The individual subsequently did not test positive for HIV.
In my case, I did 6 months in prison and also had to register as a sex offender. The stigma still follows you in terms of someone who's informally incarcerated and also someone who is living with HIV who was prosecuted under these draconian laws. And this is, again, a phenomenon that happens worldwide. So a lot of people are experiencing stigma in more than one way around the HIV status and also within the criminal justice system.
Suttle explains that in some U.S. states, once you have disclosed that you are HIV positive, you are labeled a sexual offender without ever committing a crime.
For example, in the United States, in Louisiana, they require that you put sex offender on your driver's license. So just imagine having that indicated on your passport or any form of ID that you're a registered sex offender, and just think about in a general public what that can mean. But the thing is, people living with HIV are being prosecuted simply based on their status, something that they cannot change. And as a result, the collateral consequences are they're being labeled sex offenders and predators and things like that, that are so far from the potential harm or any harm or risk that may have been done.
Both Settle and Wilding say one major way of avoiding being stigmatized criminally is for people with HIV to be educated on what is considered criminally liable. They emphasize that communities, families, stakeholders, medical workers, and lawmakers also be educated on the science of HIV. In both developed and developing countries, a person should feel safe to disclose his or her HIV status without the fear of stigmatization. Kim Lewis, VOA News, Washington.
Finally, some sad news from the music world today. The undisputed Queen of Soul has died. Aretha Franklin's gospel-style singing and bluesy delivery earned her that title. A family statement issued today says Franklin died at her home in the Midwestern city of Detroit, Michigan. She had suffered from advanced pancreatic cancer, according to her doctors. The family statement reads, "In one of the darkest moments of our lives, we are not able to find the appropriate words to express the pain in our heart. We have lost the matriarch and rock of our family." Franklin leaves behind four sons and a world of fans. She was 76 years old. We leave you with a medley VOA has put together today of some of Aretha Franklin's most beloved songs. We've been listening to a medley of some of Aretha Franklin's most popular songs throughout the decades. Franklin died today in her adopted city of Detroit. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.